Good afternoon again, ladies and gentlemen. We're back with a second briefing. This time, in addition to Ben Rhodes, the Deputy National Security Advisor to the President for Strategic Communications. Deputy National Security Advisor to the President for Strategic Communications. I have David Lipton, who is a Special Assistant to the President for International Economic Affairs, who will talk with you about, you know, there's been stories written about what developments there might be in terms of aid towards the countries in North Africa that are in a democratic transition, and David can address that for you. I'd also like to just, I think it's been made clear to you that this was originally, we had talked about embargoing this briefing. It is now, the embargo is lifted, it is on the record, on camera. The only thing that I ask is that we don't, because Ben and I are back up here again, that we, you know, Ben already did the full briefing with Mike McFaul on the President's bilat with President Medvedev, and covered a lot of ground. So let's try to keep this tight and focused. Ben and I are here and can answer questions that David can't, but let's try to get through this with dispatch. And I turn this over to David.
Thank you very much, Jay. I'd like to talk with you about what the G8 is going to be doing here in Deauville on the Middle East and North Africa, which I'll occasionally refer to as MENA region. We consider the MENA, the Middle East and North Africa, part of the G8 summit to be a highlight of the summit, something we feel is among the most important things that will be done here. The leaders will begin the discussion of the MENA region at a dinner tonight, speaking among themselves, and then have a session in the morning where they are joined with leaders from the region, including Prime Minister Sharaf from Egypt, Prime Minister El-Sebsi from Tunisia, and Mr. Amr Moussa, who is the head of the Arab League. So they'll have a chance to discuss with those leaders their plans and aspirations for change in their countries and to discuss ways in which we can be helpful. The President aims to work with his G8 colleagues and the leaders who are coming in to visit here to build on the vision for democratization and economic modernization that in the region that he laid out in his speech on May 19th. The leaders here will discuss both pillars, the political process of supporting democratic transition and governance reforms on the one hand, and the economic framework for generating sustained and inclusive growth. We believe that these two pillars go hand in hand. Without economic modernization, it will be very hard for governments trying to democratize to show people that democracy delivers. And if there's not a process of democratization, it will be very hard for these countries to find in their political systems a way to make the kind of changes that need to be made in their economies in order to deliver economic growth for people. So we have in mind always in our support for the countries in the region, trying to support both activities at the same time. We expect that you will see the G8 leaders commit here to a partnership with these two countries, Egypt and Tunisia, and with other countries in the region who are willing to go down this same path of democratization and economic modernization, as well as with those who want to support these reforms, some countries outside of the G8, some in the Middle Eastern region, we believe will want to be supportive of all of these changes and reforms. In the partnership, we and our partners will work together to develop an economic agenda to pursue these objectives. And let me talk a little about how we see the challenges that the countries face in the economic area and how the efforts of this partnership, reflecting what the President laid out last week, will be crafted to try to respond to those challenges. In the short run, the task is to support economic stability. These countries all had very positive, these two countries, Egypt and Tunisia, had very positive economic outlooks before the uprisings. These were countries that were growing, these were countries that attracted some foreign direct investment. The growth wasn't satisfactory in that it was not very inclusive, but these were growing countries. But now, through the disruptions that came along with the uprising, with the uncertainties about the future, especially the process of elections that are being crafted in both countries, and with some of the spending that countries are doing to support their populations so that the aspirations of the people are beginning to be taken account of, we're seeing growth slow, budget deficits rise, in the case of Egypt, some foreign exchange reserves being lost. And we and the countries both see the very high priority of keeping the country stable so that the backdrop for democratization is one of economic stability rather than instability and chaos. So we've called upon, and the G8, we expect the G8 to call upon the IMF to respond in helping countries shape a set of economic policies to stave off any of these financial problems. We will call upon the multilateral development banks, the World Bank, the African Development Bank, also to play a role. And we call upon friends in the region to provide finance also to help support stability. Now, while we expect, we believe that the International Monetary Fund and the MDBs will play the principal role in supporting stabilization. That is the typical thing that the IMF does. When a country, a member country in the IMF, is having economic problems and is at risk of destabilization, the IMF can be supportive in two ways. They help the country devise budgetary and budgetary policies and policies that affect their trade situation in order to, over time, make sure that there's manageable debt situation, manageable current account imbalances, and stable currencies. And then to support those reformed policies, they provide loans, and we would hope that alongside of the IMF, there would be loans from countries in the region to be supportive of those IMF efforts. So while we expect that the IMF approach will take care of the problem of stabilization in the short run, that Egypt and Tunisia face in the short run, we also are willing to play a role ourselves. The President laid out in his speech last week that the U.S. will provide some debt relief in the form of a debt swap. That comes to the tune of we will ask Congress to support the appropriation that's required to allow us to relieve Egypt of $1 billion worth of its debt service to the United States. We expect that would come over a period of 3 years. It would be in support, therefore, of democratically elected governments over the next period. And what we would do is, instead of Egypt repaying us the dollars that they owe, we would relieve them of that burden, but instead ask them to swap those obligations and put some local currency into a fund that could be used domestically for a mutually agreed upon set of purposes. We will be looking at ways to design that so that it is supportive of job creation and therefore of inclusive growth in Egypt. The President also announced $1 billion loan guarantee. That would be something provided by OPIC, which is in the business of providing such guarantees. And it would help Egypt at this time when it's difficult for them to access international capital markets, and at a time when their borrowing costs are elevated because of the uncertainties around Egypt's economy. It would help them borrow at a more reasonable cost and fund some of the expenditures that they have at this difficult time. And we would hope that we will structure that so it is helping them to finance their infrastructure budget. OPIC will also provide $2 billion in investment guarantees for private and public-private partnerships in the region. Now, those were things that the President announced. We expect that in the course of this weekend that the Europeans will themselves answer the call that the President has made for others to join us in helping the region. The European Commission launched a new effort yesterday, and I suspect that their leaders will be explaining some of the details of that here in the meetings, where they have said that they will increase their spending over the period 2011 to 2013 in what they call their neighborhood policy, which includes Central Europe and the Mediterranean, by €1.25 billion. And that in addition to that, that the European Investment Bank, which is a public sector pan-European institution, would provide $1 billion for investment in the region over that same time period. So we feel as though our efforts are being echoed now by our European partners. And all of this will help strengthen the stability of Egypt and Tunisia, something that we think is important. Now, in the longer run, the task is to build economic opportunity. As I said before, while Egypt has grown, Egypt's growth has been over 5% on average for the last 15 years. But there's certainly a sense in the country that the reforms that led to that growth have really not benefited the population very broadly. That's because it's a country that has a very controlled and state-oriented economy with controls and trade protectionism that led to the sense that the elites were able to be the main beneficiaries of growth. The economics of the situation was that state-controlled and state-dominated industry tend not to create many jobs because they're only producing for a domestic economy that has limited purchasing power at any point in time. Egypt, to maintain those state industries, has had a very protectionist international trade regime in the ranking of 139 countries from least protectionist to most protectionist. Egypt ranks 118th. The lack of having this competitive environment where the country can trade has led to very high youth unemployment, very high unemployment, and that has fed the disenchantment that led to this uprising. More broadly across, this is a problem broadly across the region, where there are 4 million young people who enter the labor force every year. So we want to see a program of economic modernization that brings down the controls on that protects state and elite-run industry and opens up the economy to competition and trade so that there can be job creation in small enterprises, job creation in enterprises that are set up by foreign direct investors. Now, the way that we hope to foster that, as the President laid out in his speech, is mainly through multilateral efforts, mobilizing the efforts of the multilateral development banks, the World Bank, the African Development Bank. But also, the President called for, and I think we will see the G8 get behind an effort to refocus the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development so that it can devote some of its present resource base to helping Egypt in the short run. Egypt is already a non-borrowing member of the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development. We aim to change that and to channel some funds to helping Egypt, but in time to turn the EBRD into a bank for transition in a broader region so that the bank can be supportive of reforms in the Middle East and North Africa as it was in Central Europe. This is a bank that has in its mandate the support for democratization. It is the only one of the international financial institutions that has that mandate. It has a staff that is oriented towards investment and private sector creation, job creation, and private sector development. So we think it is the right institution for that job. Now, another manifestation, as I mentioned, another manifestation of the misdevelopment of countries in the Middle East is the lack of openness to trade. The region has very little non-oil trade. Obviously, some of the countries are mainly oil exporters, but countries like Egypt and Tunisia are not. When you look across the region, it has the least amount of exports non-oil exports of any region in the world. In fact, the non-oil exports of this entire region of 20 countries with 400 million people are about the same as the exports of Switzerland, a country of 8 million people. And moreover, this region doesn't trade with one another. There are very rich oil-producing countries who could be buying things from non-oil-producing countries if the two parts of the region were integrated. President Obama explained in his speech that we, the United States, will launch a trade and investment partnership with those who are willing to democratize, reform, and open up. I think you will see, we expect to see the G8 sharing in this, sharing with us this commitment, and the European Union speaking about what it can do in its neighborhood through its neighborhood policies to create a greater integration, or to offer a greater integration between Europe and, in the first instance, Egypt and Tunisia, but in time, countries that are willing to go down the path of democratization and economic modernization. Getting Europe on board with this approach is extremely important because of the proximity of the region to Europe. Europe is a very natural trade partner for the countries in North Africa. So we see engagement as a long-run job. We expect that there'll be fits and starts along the way. We know that it's the people of the region who will choose the path that they want to go down, the way in which they want to democratize and bring about economic modernization. But what we've aimed to do, and what I think you'll see the G8 trying to do, is to light up that path for them, offering cooperation and support for those who want to go in a sensible direction. Let me stop with those comments and see if you want to add anything.
Go ahead, Jeff. Let's just go ahead and head to questions. Jeff.
Thank you. Two questions. The first one for you, sir. I understand a lot of what you reviewed just now came from the president's speech last week. Can you just be very succinct and clear as to what you're asking the other G8 partners to do, whether with regard to money or with regard to support? And second, a separate question, Ben, do you guys have a reaction to Libya's latest ceasefire offer? Thank you.
First, the G8 meeting of leaders we don't see as a money pledging session. We hope in this encounter, first, when the leaders meet together without the Middle Eastern leaders, to try to get people to share the vision that we have and the approach that we have, which is to understand the emphasis that has to be put on stabilization, to back the IMF providing substantial amounts of money. And, you know, the Egyptians are saying they need $12 billion in the first year of their stabilization effort. We don't know if that number is right. That's a number the Egyptians have put forward. But to task the IMF to help Egypt, and if Tunisia wants help too, to help them with strong front-loaded programs of support for reform. We want to see the other G8 countries join us also in the vision of supporting economic modernization and opening up. And there will be, we think, most important parts of that will be also multilateral. So we will need an effort where the Europeans are absolutely crucial to reorient the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, because they are major shareholders there, and to make a change in the mandate requires supermajority of votes. In the trade area, of course, trade is bilateral. And for us, it's something for USTR to undertake. But for Europe, it requires the collective action of the European Union to do. And so having a discussion among the Europeans about that all-important subject, I think, is key. in the meetings with the prime ministers of Egypt and Tunisia and the head of the Arab League, we hope to hear from leaders how they have mapped out the process of democratization and how they see the economic challenges so that we can try to devise approaches in time that will respond to their circumstances. Now, on the money, while this meeting is not about pledging, we are setting in motion here a process that will address the financial questions, the ones that you asked. There will be in the, I believe that we will see a schedule set out for foreign ministers, for finance ministers of this partnership to meet in the course of the summer and the fall in order to take up the specific question, what are the financial needs for stabilization, for economic modernization, what role can be played multilaterally by the international financial institutions, and how will we mobilize additional support, including from the countries in the region who have the resources to play a role and have a distinct interest in the stability of their neighboring countries.
Yeah, I'd to your other question, but first, I think it's important to think about what the G8 does to catalyze action. I think there's several points to it. Number one, the G8 can serve as a forum to underscore the commitment of an important segment of the international community to an issue. We're sending a powerful signal to the region that we can help in this one specific area, economic stabilization and growth, that's going to be fundamental to consolidating democracies. So number one, it's sending that message. Number two, it is catalyzing some action. We announced the $1 billion in debt swaps, the additional investment resources associated with OPIC and other efforts in the President's speech. The European Commission, of course, made the announcements that David referred to around its own commitment of resources. So I think the G8 serves to help catalyze that action and serves as a place for nations to kind of put their commitments on the table, and that's what the U.S. and the Europeans have done here in advance of tomorrow's meetings. And then third, it's to agree upon a plan of action and to stake out the course that can be taken going forward to get the resources to the Egyptians and the Tunisians and to do so in a way that makes sure that their economies are reforming and modernizing, and we can use the unique expertise and resources and experiences of the G8 members and, of course, a broader European allies and partners to support that. So, again, it's a clear message. It catalyzes resources, and it lays out an action plan. And I think that is going to do a substantial amount to help consolidate democratic gains with economic growth. On the Libya question, we've said repeatedly that proposals from the Gaddafi regime are not credible unless they take actions. They've put forward all kinds of proposals, but we still see their forces again in a mode of attacking population centers. We still see the troops out of the barracks. Again, a proposal itself is not going to cut it. They know exactly what is in that UN Security Council resolution. They're not complying with it, and therefore. We're going to continue to be engaged in the effort that we're pursuing with our coalition partners.
Chip?
Could you talk about the President's leadership role in this? Would the Egypt and Tunisia plan be a major issue at this summit if the President hadn't pushed it? How aggressively is he lobbying this, and where does it rank on his list of priorities?
I think that this is something, actually, that the President consulted with and has had conversations with a number of his counterparts about for some time. I think that when the President and European leaders began to look at where can we make a difference, we can obviously in the immediate term through tools like sanctions and other means try to affect transitions, but when it comes to investing in democratic success, where can we make a difference? The President identified the economic space as one where the U.S. and Europe were uniquely capable providing expertise, resources, partnership that could, again, consolidate democratic gains through economic growth. And this grew out of the transitions that we studied, and a lot of you asked us about this. And one of the things we learned in reviewing democratic transitions in the past is those nations that are successful almost always needed to have some kind of expanded and broader-based prosperity to show that democracy delivers for its citizens. So this is something that the President was very focused on as we prepared for both these meetings and the speech he gave. I think a number of other European leaders shared the view as well. It's certainly been the case for the European members of the G8 who are here today. So I think there was a collective recognition. I think what the President also was able to do in advance of the G8 is to put forward in a public way the set of ideas that we think are most important to this, whether it's around debt relief, debt swaps, trade and investment, reorienting some of the resources of the European Reconstruction and Development Bank, and a long-term vision of trade and investment integration in the region with the United States and our European allies. So last week, I think what he did is lay out, here's the path as I see it, here's the vision as I see it, here are the steps the United States is going to put on the table and the commitments that we're going to make, knowing that we're going to be coming together here at the G8 to catalyze this. And in terms of our priorities, you know, the President said it's a top priority in his speech to support the success of democratic change in the region. And we believe that this is a fundamental pillar of how you support that democratic success, because statements are important, diplomacy is important, but in the long run, democracy has to have concrete benefits for people. And this is the clearest way to ensure that those concrete benefits follow from democratic transition.
Julie?
Have you guys discussed in the U.S. and with your European partners about what happens to the assets that you're going to give to Tunisia and Egypt if the democratic transitions there don't take hold, if the elections don't go the way you think they're going to go, or if they don't happen at all?
The President made clear in his speech that our support would depend upon countries going forward with democratization and economic modernization. Now, you know, in the U.S. we have various ways to examine bilateral support to make sure that those conditions will be that situation will be satisfactory. The International Monetary Fund has a different set of procedures. They lend in installments as the reforms that they've agreed upon with the country progress. And so, of course, there won't be programs unless there's an agreement on a path forward, and then there won't be a continuation of financial support over time unless there's continued progress along the path. So it's a kind of a graduated approach, help for self-help, calibrated along a path.
And I'd just say one more thing, Julie, because it's exactly the right question. You know, first, there are the steps that these countries are going to be taking, and again, this type of assistance and these types of programs are meant to reinforce that. But also, it's meant to create an incentive for other countries, right? So if you have governments who are considering democratic reforms, you have citizens who are considering whether to continue to pursue their rights and aspirations. If they can see positive models, it shows that there's an incentive to get behind democracy, that you can have a relationship, a trade and investment relationship, a relationship with the international community that delivers for your citizens if you move to democracy. So it's both a program of support for Egypt and Tunisia, but it's also a message to the broader region that democracy delivers. And then if you pursue that path, there's going to be support on the other end. And you know, that's why I think it's so important to send that signal, because it's relevant not just to those two countries, but to all the countries in the region.
Carol?
Given the role that you guys are asking the IMF to take in this this effort, do you think it's important that the European leadership remains in the IMF? I mean, if the IMF and other European institutions are getting this mandate, does it make sense to say Mexico take over?
I think, you know, as we've said, it's the best person for the job, and we want someone who's well qualified, ready to meet the challenges that we face, and we're supportive of the IMF's efforts and different nations' efforts to identify that person. And I'll also say, you know, the IMF continues to play a fundamental role here, as an institution that is capable of dealing with this type of fundamental stabilization. But I don't think it would affect the calculus in terms of nationality.
Given that in the past some of the G8 countries have failed to meet their stated aid goals to regions like sub-Saharan Africa, is there any concern that this might happen in this instance?
I didn't mention it because it's outside of the Middle East North Africa session, but there will be a session on Africa on the second day of the summit, a meeting with a group of African leaders. And in preparation for that session, work has been done on accountability. And for the first time, we have paired reports, a report by donor countries, but also a report by African countries that was put together by NEPAD, the African group of African countries pursuing development. And I think what you'll see in there, this year's accountability report focuses on global health and food security. And you'll see in there both numbers that show country by country the performance of G8 countries in fulfilling their obligations. And you'll see the aggregate for the G8. The United States, you will see, has done what it said it was going to do. The record more generally is a bit mixed. We certainly aim for this accountability exercise to be one that allows people to see how commitments are carried through, and we think that that's important. Right now we're talking principally, when we talk about the Middle East and North Africa, we're talking principally about multilateral funding, so it wouldn't be quite the same. But certainly, we believe that we should be serious about the commitments that we make. They can be conditional, as we were just suggesting, and we think that's appropriate in the case of the Middle East. But we want to see countries follow through.
How much of a consensus there is between member states to deal with Syria? And just noticing on the draft communique, it reflects the language of U.S. position a few weeks ago, and it doesn't go as far as calling on Bashar al-Assad to choose between leading a transition or getting out of the way.
I wouldn't comment on the communique before it's out, but what I will say is that there is, there's broad agreement certainly among the United States, the European Union, and our European allies about the need to ramp up pressure on Bashar Assad, the need to build out our sanctions, and we've done that alongside the European Union to designate more individuals around Bashar Assad, to designate Bashar Assad himself as we did recently. And so I think there is a unified position in terms of sending a clear message that, again, if he continues down the path of crackdown, we're going to continue to escalate the pressure that we can apply, particularly through those focused sanctions, that he has a message. He has a message that he's receiving from his own people, which is he can either lead a democratic transition or he can leave. And so that's certainly the uniform, certainly the view of the United States, and is a position that is held by our European allies in terms of the actions that they've taken on the accountability side. And the messages that we've all sent through our words. And it's also served, I think, in some respects, to isolate Syria also in some international fora, the Human Rights Council, for instance. It's something that will be a focus of conversation, I'm sure, at the bilateral with President Sarkozy and in the meetings tomorrow. And then we'll have the communique at the end of the meetings.
Let's just do, if I could, just two more, Chuck and Alex. Are you going to ask, are you trying to get more support from all of the G8 countries for the president's vision on the Middle East peace process, specifically the 67 borders, sort of hoping for similar statements like you got from Cameron yesterday, one. Two, are you guys going to announce where the U.S. is hosting the G8 before we leave here?
On the first question, we believe it's very important to have those expressions of support. Principally, the most important one out of the box was from the quartet, which is we see as kind of the principal catalyst for international support for peace. The quartet, of course, including our European allies, the United Nations and Russia. And the quartet put out a very strong statement expressing full support for the president's vision as a basis for negotiations. And then coming in behind that, I think, Prime Minister Cameron made a very strong statement about the importance of the president's speech and how it is, again, a basis for negotiations. You know, we believe that will be a topic of conversation with President Sarkozy, of course, as well, who's taken an active interest in Middle East peace, and that there'll be discussions kind of on the margins. Middle East peace is not an agenda item at the G8, but so it'll come up in those discussions on the margins. But we think it's important that the international community speak in a very clear way about the path towards peace, about the role that it can play to get the parties back to the table, to address some of the outstanding concerns associated with that effort. And it's certainly going to be something that we build upon from the quartet statement, Prime Minister Cameron's statement, and the discussions we have tomorrow.
Alex, what about the location?
Oh, location. We have
no. We don't intend to announce that during this summit.
Yeah.
Alex? Can I clarify the sums that you mentioned? It's about $2 billion for the U.S., $2 billion for OPEC, a couple of billion from European Commission and the European Bank.
Back over.
Yeah.
The President? I got this. The President announced a $1 billion debt swap that will relieve Egypt of $1 billion of debt obligations, a $1 billion loan guarantee program that will be financed by, provided by OPIC, the Overseas Private Investment Corporation. Those are both for Egypt. And $2 billion of investment guarantees that can be for private or public-private partnership investments for the region, but they will be largely in Egypt and Tunisia. Did you want to talk about the EC numbers as well?
Yeah,
okay. Then the EC, Lady Ashton made an announcement yesterday that they have a program that is for the neighborhood countries, Central Europe and the Southern Mediterranean, that already had certain amounts of money scheduled for the period 2011 to 2013. And that what they've indicated is an intention to increase that amount by €1.25 billion. And that's money to be that they intend to spend over the period 2011 to 2013. Now, some of it will be in Central Europe, but they intend now, with what's going on in the Middle East, to have heavy emphasis on the North Africa. They've also announced that the European Investment Bank, which is a public institution, a pan-European institution, will increase the amount of its investments in North Africa by €1 billion.
And when will money start getting to these countries? And so do you have a total sum that you're looking for? How much, do you have a round figure of what you're looking for?
Well, the truth is that the total sum is something that awaits some discussion between, in the case of Egypt, Egypt and the IMF. One has to understand the scope of the stabilization challenge in order to do that. And then the multilateral piece will be determined and the bilateral piece is added to it. So I think that it's premature to talk about a total amount with a year-by-year phasing, but this will be refined in the course of the coming couple of months. There'll be, as I said, there'll be a finance ministry group that will discuss this, and finance ministers themselves will discuss it when they next meet. And at that, by that point, the IMF action plan will have been refined, and the bilateral. How the bilateral monies fit in with that will be refined, but we don't really have that yet.
Is Tunisia asked for a certain amount of money, as Egypt said in these 12 billion? Has Tunisia come up with a sum like that?
We'll have, I mean, the Tunisian Prime Minister will be here tomorrow. He may, but he has not yet.
Thank you all very much.